This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Thank you very much for having me as a guest speaker. I've enjoyed being a guest meditator in this space a few times this year, and it's really become a space of refuge, of sweetness for me. I've been very grateful for the hospitality of the Zendo, letting me stay overnight a couple of times, because, you know, I work with Max at UCSF and at Parnassus and live in Oakland, so sometimes it's been really pleasant for me to stay overnight here and to come to Zazen in the morning. We were talking out there, really beats spending that 40 minutes commuting and waiting for buses and trains. So I'm grateful for the hospitality of this Zen Center to me, and am really just beyond honored to have been asked to share a little bit of the wisdom of my tradition with you this morning. So the topic comes from Kabbalah, which is the mystical tradition that's part of Judaism. You may find some of it in some way applicable, recognizable. I hope that you do. The Jewish mystics were certainly in touch with both Hindu and Buddhist mystics for a good 1,000 years, just from merchants. That correspondence is not an area of my expertise, but there certainly are correspondences to be appreciated, and I do believe that, you know, we become richer by interacting. So I hope that's the case for us this morning. One thing that I should say, kind of before we go into Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, is that there is one sort of factor that I think, you know, our practices share between, you know, my home base in Judaism and Buddhism, and maybe particularly Zen Buddhism, which is that we do, I think, struggle with a certain commercialization of our tradition. You know, so that the Kabbalah that you may hear about in the commercial world,
Madonna,
with Madonna and the red string and, you know, and all of this stuff that, you know, if it makes a lot of money, it probably isn't Kabbalah. You know, and that may be something, I see some nodding heads, that may be something that's familiar. I see, you know, commercial sort of presentations of Zen or things that claim to be Zen really all over the world of marketing, especially in this town. And, you know, and I come here and it's like, well, you know, there isn't so much of that. So one thing to kind of be aware of is just to sort of forget what you may have heard about Kabbalah, and come to it with that blank slate that we always try to achieve, and that's a great place to be. That really is. So with that kind of palate cleanser, I want to talk about the sefirot, which are 10 sort of emanations of the divine, and I'm going to focus on two of them, which is chesed on the right side and gevura on the left side. We'll talk about those in quite some depth, but I just want to kind of paint a picture for you of these what we call sefirot. The word is a cognate to sphere, also to sapphire, and it's an emanation. So the idea is that the divine is far bigger than we can even begin to comprehend. That force, whatever you want to call it, none of our words are adequate for it. And we have a shorthand for it that we call without end, limitlessness, Ein Sof, endlessness, endless. And what it means is that nothing that we say is adequate to describe the ultimate reality. And so in some sense, we sort of shouldn't try. And if we do try, we should acknowledge that we're not quite getting it. So we call it Ein Sof. There's nothing more to be said about Ein Sof. That's it. Nothing more to be said. But we here on Earth need something to interact with. And we find that within Judaism, through the concept of sovereignty, through the concept that someone is in charge, doesn't have to be endorsed, I'm just, that's kind of where we are. And that is the lowest level. And we kind of proceed, you can proceed in mystical consciousness up from there. And so the top level is this kind of endlessness that we could never reach, no matter if we lived forever, we would just never reach it. The lowest level is the concept of sovereignty, and you know, in Judaism we would say the sovereignty of God. And then we kind of, there's kind of a middle set of levels. There are 10 sefirot. They're arranged in a diagram that we call the Tree of Life. I'm not going to paint it for you. It's too complicated. It also looks a little bit like the human body. There's a left side and a right side, and there are 7 levels, which scholars have corresponded with the chakras. I don't doubt that that was part of the correspondence between, you know, our traditions over a millennium, and but I don't have a whole lot to say about it. Where we're going to be focusing today, though, is at the level of Chesed and Gevurah. It's the 5th level up, which I think is the throat chakra. And as I said, there's a left side and a right side to it. And so this is like the left side of divinity and the right side of divinity. On the right is Chesed. Chesed means in Hebrew literally kindness. It has to do with generosity. It has to do with overflowing abundance. It has to do with I call it the divine saying yes. Okay, granting a request is chesed. Okay, taking it easy is chesed. It overflows all boundaries with over surpassing love. Okay, that's chesed on the right. My left, your right. My right, your left. On the other side, on the left side is gevurah, and gevurah is about boundaries. It's about strictness. It's about discipline. It can be about severity. I like to say Gevurah is the divine saying no. It's that part of the divine that says no. Denying is Gevurah. Denying a request. So the first thing to understand is that these are both divine. They are both part of divinity. They're part of what is good. They're part of that life force of the world. Big, huge spiritual mistake that that people make who might be novices at this is that they will assume that Chesed is good and Gevurah is bad or evil. That is a big mistake. Both of them are important and necessary. Chesed is certainly more pleasant than Gevurah. Gevurah is definitely unpleasant, but we need them both. And, you know, one of the things I certainly, you know, admire about this space is that I think we have them both in some abundance. You want to be in balance, and in balance you find a third sefirah that's kind of underneath the two of them that's in the middle, which is called Tiferet, which means beauty. And beauty comes from having, you know, the correct measure and the correct timing of saying yes and saying no. Saying yes to others, saying no to others. Saying yes to ourselves, saying no to ourselves. So to take an example, when I meditate, I couldn't begin to teach meditation here at the Zendo, but I'll just tell you my personal experience. When I meditate, I am, you know, the work I try to do in kind of erasing my thoughts, it's not easy. I don't always succeed as well as other times. But, you know, that can be a lot of, it can take a lot of chesed to kind of erase the boundaries of the thoughts and to just kind of let things be. But it is not an activity of pure chesed. That's not right. Pure chesed would be falling asleep during meditation. There's also the need to keep the spine erect. There's what you know I'm okay at, right? There's the need to, you know, to sit for a length of time. There's the need to learn not to scratch every itch for me, which can be a distraction, and which I'm working on, right? The idea of practice, the idea of consistent practice at something to be better at it is gevura. To be able to build up the capacity to give ourselves the kindness of chesed. Okay? So I find that, you know, where we really want to be is kind of in that balance. It's not good to be too far on either one side or on the other side. So, you know, when I do get up, let's suppose I've stayed overnight here at the Zen Center, and I do choose to get up for morning practice, right? That's gevura. Maybe I'm tired. You know, I say, gosh, I'd rather just stay in bed. You know, and there's always that period of time right after we sort of wake up where we're still in a little bit of sleep inertia, and we say, can I just snooze that alarm, right? What I want right now is to just kind of snooze, right? To snooze is chesed, right? That's pleasant. It's, you know, to pull that blanket back over ourselves and not get out of bed, right? To get up it takes some strength, right? Gevura is about strength. Actually, gevura means strength. I might have said that. So when we're too far on one side, too far on the other side, we are out of balance. Now, this is not a good thing. So too far off on the gevura side, we end up with, we might become an angry person. We might become, and this gets a lot of attention, we might become somebody who isn't sufficiently kind to other people, doesn't have enough patience. We might be irritable. Too far afield from that, you get war and destruction and murder and all kinds of horrible things come from too much gevura. And so very often in communities, we think of that as something to avoid, right? We don't want too much of that. It's dangerous. Right? Gevura is destructive, right? It's dangerous. On the other hand, too much chesed, the idea of being too imbalanced on the side of kindness, does not get enough attention. Too often people think that the more kindness, the better. Well, not so. No. Not without balance. Too much kindness, we become a yes person who can't say no to anybody, right? Spineless, cowardly, depressed. And I, you know, in my life, I struggle with bipolar disorder, so I live with depression. And there's nothing like the experience of just sort of not ever wanting to get out of bed ever, taking an hour and a half to put on a sock, right? Some people skip medication. And I work full-time with Max at UCSF Medical Center, and I'm one of the places I'm based is the mental hospital. So I, you know, I'm not only a patient myself, but also a chaplain in a mental health inpatient setting where, you know, I help people. And, you know, and I can see the toll depression takes on the gevura, right? There's a real imbalance on the side of chesed, and it becomes very, very difficult to have the discipline to stick to a routine, to do those healthful things that will help. You know, eating too much candy, right? It's chesed, stress eating, you know, whatever that might be. Engaging in an unhealthy habit, addiction. So, you know, failures of personal responsibility. Too much chesed, not enough gevurah. We need to say no. Sometimes we need to say no to ourselves, as well as to say no to others. Bullying, tough problem, right? Bullies, too much gevurah, not enough kindness, right? The bullied often have too much on the side, on the right side of kindness, and not enough on the left side of strength, and can sometimes be helped by really thinking about the strength side and building that up, and saying no. I don't want to blame victims, but you know, it's not always people's fault. But sometimes that is a way toward greater strength, to learn to say no to those who would deny us. And it's all about that balance. Too much of that and you just get into a fist fight. Right? That's not the answer. But to have the power to keep somebody else at the table to negotiate, and to have the kindness to find a solution that might work for both, is the way of integrative negotiation, is a way to create value, and is certainly, in Kabbalah, the way of bringing wisdom to the situation. And it is not always easy. I don't want to sound too much like a mathematical formula or a recipe where you just kind of put some chesed in here and put some gevurah on the other side and mix it up and it's fine, right? It's the mixing that's difficult, right? That takes skill. And it isn't always possible either, unfortunately. Sometimes it's possible, but beyond my or your ability, right? But that's where we want to be. That's where we want to keep our focus, on the ability to have the spine to stick up for what's right, and to have the kindness to bring everyone else into that circle. Okay, so we think of kindness as overflowing boundaries, because the abundance and generosity of kindness is just overflowing. Think of it as a liquid. All right, it just goes everywhere. And that's wonderful. That can be really wonderful. You know, kind of sugar water, I don't know. It just turns everything into candy. It's great, right? It needs a container in order to hold it, right? We need boundaries, right? I'm a religious leader, right? If I show love to everybody in the same way, I can get into some very, very serious problems that are not okay at all. And that may come from not enough boundaries, right? So I have a lot of love to give to people, but I need to have boundaries and containers, right? As a religious leader, as somebody in an empowered position, in order to make sure that rules are followed, right? So Gevurah is like that container. And one of the great teachings from the Gevurah side is the idea that containers, boundaries, and strength, spine, are kind of made of the same thing, right? One is an exoskeleton, a container, and one is an endoskeleton, a spine, but what they have in common is giving structure to the structureless. Where chesed wants to just pour all over everything indiscriminately, Gevurah says, we're going to have a shape, and we're going to intentionally place ourselves in a particular arrangement to fit with other things. Okay, so there's the idea of of kindness that really wants to overflow boundaries, and the boundaries themselves that say no, we're going to restrict that into a shape that we can build something with. Okay. So, internal and external. If you break the boundaries, the kindness kind of oozes out, right? Could be good. Too much of it and it oozes all over the floor and there's no structure to it and you can get into problems. Okay. Hope everybody's thinking of questions. Two things to say about the issue of the boundary. Think back to what I said about the emanations of the divine coming from above and ending kind of below. Kindness and strength, chesed and gevurah, are on the same level, but And they correspond to the fifth level up, the third level down, which in the chakras would be the throat level. Chesed comes first, and then Gevurah. Okay? So the divinity flows kind of down through kindness, and then into boundaries and structure, and then into the beauty and the balance. So what it means to say is that you need to first have the kindness, right? Reality flows through the idea of kindness, that everything in the universe is kind to everything else. Right? And then the idea of boundaries becomes sort of invented, and boundaries crystallize to form that kindness into shapes and things and people. And then once you have both of them, you can proceed to the idea of balance. Okay. So from our perspective, looking up from below, the boundaries are what we see first. Okay, we're kind of like, think of a goblet and we're underneath it. So we see the goblet. The goblet is full of kindness, but what we see is the vessel. And, you know, and sometimes there needs to be some spiritual work, some mystical work involved in bringing ourselves up to the level where we can see the kindness within that vessel and access that. But we, you know, in our physical world, we need our kindness to have shape. And so we interact through shapes. From the divine perspective, looking down from above, the kindness is actually bigger than the vessel. This is a little bit of fourth dimensional thinking here. But to us from below, the kindness is inside the vessel. To the divine from above, the vessel is inside the kindness. The kindness is actually bigger. And, you know, and by, you know, through meditation, through personal mystical work and community work, it is possible to access a greater understanding of that kindness in a wise way that doesn't cause us to tip the vessel over like a novice and spill it all out onto the floor, right? And whoops, right? And create problems. I mean, really, we create problems when we spill the chesed out of its container. But we want to interact with it being inside the container and having those boundaries. My teacher, Rabbi Natan Margalit, says that living boundaries are very real. Think of a cell, a biological cell wall. Living boundaries are very real, but they're porous. And through the exercise of gevurah, of keeping things in and keeping the inside in and keeping the outside out, but also through the exercise of intentional kindness, of opening up gates, they achieve a balance where those boundaries end up being a little bit blurred, and they're membranes and they're permeable. They're permeable at the right times for the right reasons. And that's really the wisdom of being in balance. So natural systems aren't about building impenetrable fortresses, right? Natural systems, living systems, our world, trees and all of that, are about cells that that keep the inside in and keep the outside out, but are in conversation about it and are able to talk about it. Okay. So, I think the idea really is that, we need both. We need the pleasant and the unpleasant. We need the disciplined and the, charitable. We need the kindness and the strength. And the one thing I guess I would finally sort of leave you with, is to not be afraid of gevurah, right? One of the big mistakes I said is just thinking gevurah is evil. The other one is sort of fear of it. It's a rookie mistake, right? There's nothing to be afraid of. It can be very jarring. If you let gevurah energy into your life, it's going to destroy some assumptions that you had. I mean, I have had this happen to me on a few occasions, a couple of them big. Gevurah can be a very creative destruction. It can be frightening. It can be scary. This Zen center is a place that is a historic place in the LGBT community. And anybody who's been through the experience of coming out knows what creative destruction is about. And there's, you know, some of us have an easier time of it than others, but everyone who's been through that experience knows that there's something about that initial world that's gone and that isn't going to come back and that is going to be replaced with something else. It takes a lot of spine to go through that experience. That is not easy to do. And so anybody who's done that is like a gevurdich person, somebody who really has a lot of that gevurah energy to, you know, to practice and to teach, right? It is scary. There is no question that it's scary. And there's no question that chesed is warm and kind and sort of warm and fuzzy, right? We like chesed better than we like gevurah. There's no question about it. Couldn't live a life with only gevurah. But let's not be afraid of it either. It's not bad. It's part of what's good about the world, and it's part of what enables us to be balanced people and people who have some power and can make our world into the kind of better place that I think everybody wants it to be. So the key is not to run to the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. Neither is the key to sort of rush headlong into the unpleasant and become angry, right? The key is to be in balance. So I'm going to say thank you and maybe open it up to some questions. I'm really anxious to hear your questions. So thank you very much. Evan.
Maybe this is just the traditional view, but I've heard it said that only married heterosexual males are allowed to study Kabbalah. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, and you have to be 40. Fortunately, I'm 40 now, so this is, yesterday was my 40 and a half birthday. So I'm even a little older than 40. You know, that is something, Abbott, that I think has gone through some creative destruction. That's a part of the fortress that has crumbled. I'm not sure I'm sorry to see it go. But I will say in its defense, not in defense of that particular stricture, but in defense of, and I don't know about the heterosexual thing, I think there's just a lot of bias against LGBT people in religion, anyhow, not enough listening, not enough kindness. You know, that's an imbalance, right? There is something to be said for protecting the esoteric. There's something to be said for the idea that mystical knowledge is powerful. You know, whether you believe in it supernaturally or whether you simply want to say that knowledge of a deep, high level knowledge of the way people work. Of the way sort of it works is something that can enable people to do a great amount of good or harm. And a high-level mystical practitioner who doesn't care about people turns into a cult leader, right? Turns into all sorts of awful things. And so there's something to be said for the idea of keeping the mystical kind of restricted to a group that is initiated. That is sort of ready for it. Now, that takes different forms. You know, the form that kind of restriction takes today is different, and I think I'm happy that it's different, right, than even 50 years ago, certainly 100 years ago in Judaism. But I think there's still something to be said for keeping in mind that there does need to be some sort of restriction, and you know, we would not necessarily offer the keys to power, certainly over people, publicly. I think there really is something to be said for the esoteric here. Fortunately, I believe that the esoteric really isn't available in truth to people who aren't ready for it. And I don't claim to be a big expert myself. I'm just saying that, you know, I think that the divine is imbued with an intention for the world that it should be good and that people should be well. And that somebody who really is just bent on remaking that into the image of personal power or wealth or whatever it is really has not yet stumbled upon the truth and ultimately is going to be stopped by that truth. So, long-winded answer to a short question, Abbott. Yes, sir.
I have two questions. So I gather from what you're saying that you won't find guided meditations in Kabbalah on YouTube.
Oh, well, you know, there's a lot out there. There's a lot. I have friends in the rabbinate who do guided meditations. I think some of them are very good. They don't, personally, this is my own personal sort of preference, and it's not right or wrong. I actually prefer silent meditation to guided meditation. And it's one of the reasons I sort of like to come here every so often. This is where I feel a little bit more, I don't know, it's not a better or a worse. It's just that I really enjoy taking silence seriously. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with guided meditation. The potential problem is what that guided meditation is saying, right? Some of them are definitely better than others. Yeah, and you have to be careful.
So there are YouTube videos.
Pardon me?
There are videos on YouTube on how to do Kabbalah meditation.
I would imagine there are. Yeah, I haven't done a whole lot of searching. I would imagine there are. But the only cautionary note, again, is sort of as is the case with Zen in our culture, let the buyer beware, right? Another question?
Part two. I at one time was doing some reading, and I think it was the Zohar?
Yeah.
Yes, and a long time ago, so I don't remember much about it, but I remember something about a figure named Adam Kadmon.
Adam Kadmon. The Kadmon means the original, or the ancient, maybe, the ancient. Kedem is the ancient past, and so Adam Kadmon is Adam or Adam, person, the original. Nowadays in Judaism, there are people named Adam. My brother's name is Adam, great guy. But in sort of biblical Hebrew, Adam really isn't a proper name. It became that later. Adam is, it means person. It's a word that means person. And so in Israel, in modern Hebrew, if you say, you know, if you know you're not talking about somebody's first name, right? And the word Adam means someone, you know? And so the first someone in the Jewish story was this Adam Kadmon, right? Who was supposed to be androgynous. And the rabbis derive this from the stories of, it says male and female, God created them. And so the rabbis derive that the original Adam was both male and female, was androgynous, immensely large. I mean, there's the story.
They're intersex.
Pardon me?
They're intersex.
Intersex, okay. Say more about that.
It means to actually be born with male and female.
Oh, intersex. Yeah. So so Adam Kadmon was intersex according to the rabbis, right? Right. I thought you said intersects. Like
intersex.
Intersex. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so in some ways that's closer to creation. Adam Kadmon was supposed to be 65,000, I forget, units of measure wide, and was this immensely tall, immensely large person. Mm. I think there's a lot of really crazy stories there. I think the idea was that, you know, the original person is something that is much bigger than us today, but is something that is interesting to sort of contemplate on and see if we can get close to the original reality, right? The intersex reality, absolutely. Of that. Yeah, that's where we come from.
Yeah, it makes me wonder about like old cultures and their
mm-hmm.
awareness of intersex as being a thing. Like, we're just reintegrating that in our culture now. Like,
yeah.
We suppressed it. And
yeah, and that, I'm
people
glad.
People were not aware of it up until, I mean, really a few years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Or we forgot. That's a very central point to this today, and especially here, you know, in this space.
Did the notion of Adam being intersex, did that come from Kabbalah, or does that happen earlier?
That comes from earlier, actually. Yeah. That's back in the rabbinic era. As far as I know, that's in Genesis Rabbah. So I think you're talking kind of in the 200, 300 of the Common Era time. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure that's when that comes from. And the rabbis were pretty radical people back then. But, you know, intersex and the diversity of human gender and sexuality and sex is part of the reality of the world. And, you know, the idea that ancient cultures were somehow unaware of it is ridiculous, right? Of course people were aware, right? And there are cultural views on homosexuality that are both positive and negative in the ancient cultures of the world, right? Well, we went astray. And this is a really great point. There's a temptation to purity. There's a temptation to assume that just because the majority is something, everything has to be that way, which is not authentic to the way the world is. And is really very dangerous, and is I think comes from again a deficiency of chesed, the inability to appreciate somebody from the place where they are, the desire to have power over them, and it disguises itself. It's just sort of it tells a lie, and it disguises itself very insidiously as oh how beautiful it is when everybody's the same. Right. Well, there are two ways to have the beauty of sameness. Right. One is to sort of box everybody into the same box, to stretch the short ones and cut off the tall ones and make everybody exactly the same, right? To bleach the darker ones and tan the lighter ones. It's really an awful way to be, to enforce the idea that everybody has to be exactly the same just because some people are, right? And, you know, you get racism in our culture. We have a majority white culture, and there's the idea that if people aren't white, they're not as beautiful. It's ridiculous, right? The other gateway to the sort of placidness of the idea that we're all, think of placid waters, that we're all at the same level, we're all in some ways the same, we're all related to the original person, right, is to understand that diversity is part of the original person, right? And so therefore the whole human family where people look very different on the surface, right? We're all, what beauty is there in, what great beauty in the idea that we're all related as part of the same family? What a great idea, right? And I think that's the teaching of the original person, is that we're all in the same family. You know, the rabbis say, the reason that we were created out of the same family from Adam is so that nobody should boast of their lineage and say, my father was greater than yours, right? Well, that's beautiful, right? The idea that we have a big family and a family of great diversity and many different body types and many different, you know, genders, and yet we're all kind of part of the same family. Well, that's beautiful, right? In some ways, we're equal. As opposed to that sort of illusory, very dangerous, I would say heresy from my perspective, of imagining that, you know, we drill down to one characteristic and anybody who doesn't share that characteristic is sort of harshing our mood, and so we exclude those people. And I think that you know, that's a gateway to a very bad kind, a very brittle kind of sameness, that is unequivocally the wrong way. And it forgets, and the test is right back to the original Adam. It forgets that we're all part of the same family, right? So if somebody says, well, you're not good enough because you're LGBTQI, you know, no. I mean, that's not it. You know, if there's a racism or there's a sexism or there's, you know, any of these other, you know, sort of petty little bigotries, and people say, well, you're not good enough to be here because you're not one of us. Well, that's gotten out of touch with the truth of the human family. And that's a very narrow and mistaken idea of what the of what human sameness is about. And so I think we need to help people get out of that when they've fallen into it.
I have a question, you know, because sort of switching subject a little bit, but you know, being Zen students, and Zen has a lot of, which is a structured one, the structured one, Havor, I'm sorry, what's the Hebrew for the?
Gevurah,
right?
Thank you.
But it's very external. Mm-hmm. So like I lived in a situation like that where it's very structured, almost like the mental hospital, like, you know, very structured, your whole, but it didn't necessarily give me that inner strength or that inner spine. It's still something that I'm having to develop.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm also wondering if having that external could actually even make it harder to
mm-hmm.
develop an inner strength. What, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, sometimes, right?
Okay.
So I would go to Rabbi Ishbitzer Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Liner, who was a 19th century rabbi in Poland, who has an idea about this, and he says that rules, you know, things that are imposed on us externally, right, are great for us at the initial stage, right? So if you're a novice and, you know, it's your first time doing something, it's really good for you to be told what to do, to get it right. You know, the first time I came into the Zendo, I was really memorizing, like, when you bow, you know, I want to do the right thing, right? And so there's a structure and turning clockwise and sort of, you know, and screwing it up and saying, oh, I screwed that up, you know, and getting it, you know, closer to right next time. But really focusing on those rules, right? And just to lay a foundation, to feel comfortable, to show respect for your space. And that's a very, very basic set of rules, okay? Not to talk during meditation, right? I mean, very, very basic kinds of things, right? Not to have my phone ring when I'm here, etc., right? As we grow in our practice, you know, one of the things that happens is that we can take, you know, from the shape of that exoskeleton, we can make ourselves an endoskeleton. And to try to stand on our own 2 feet, to try to strengthen and make erect our own spine, rather than leaning on the externally imposed rules. So that's where we want to be. If we never get there, or worse, if the person in power, there's always somebody, tries to prevent us from getting there, that's not good. That doesn't help us grow. Right, and so a good teacher will slowly sort of relax the supervision of those rules, and a good student will learn where those permeable membrane boundaries are and make exceptions once in a while in ways that make sense, and learn to handle those ambiguous situations that are right on the border themselves. But they can't do it at first. So, you know, so we start with a very kind of constricted exoskeleton, and the idea is to grow to where we sort of need that less and less when we're able to provide it for ourselves.
Thank you. It's helpful.
Yeah.
In Buddhism, I feel like we do have this parallel. I mean, you talked about basically the middle way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an essential teaching of the Buddha, is to practice this a middle way between asceticism on one hand and self-indulgence
mm-hmm.
on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in there is this experience of our essential nature, which is kind of fathomless and compassionate. And compassion is not such a wishy-washy term, like it's not totally on the right side. It actually takes many forms. It can be very stern
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
like I mean, certainly in Zen, we present ourselves with a lot of gevura.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's a lot of structure. We come in and we bow in a certain way, and we try to do things the right way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that it leads to, I mean, there's, in one of the chants, it leads to ease and joy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it leads to at least coming closer to this experience of your essential nature. And there's a real trust that develops through practice, at least I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So you and I have had this conversation before, and if not us personally, then our spiritual ancestors have definitely had this conversation before. Yeah, no question in my mind.
Yeah, yeah, it strikes me that that must have been true, that, I mean, Buddhism and, I mean, first of all, like, right now, there's a whole term, like, for Jubus.
Jubus, yeah.
Jubus.
Yeah, Jubus. Jubus. There's, you know, the book The Jew and the Lotus. My congregational rabbi when I lived in Boston, Moshe Waldox, was in that book, and
you knew one of the characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's, that was really a thing. You know, one of the things that happened in Judaism is that when we came to America, we gave up a lot of the old strictures. People had kind of not been believing in them anyway, and it's a new country, and we wanted to do new things. But with that, we also sort of threw the baby out of the bathwater, with the bathwater a little bit, and we gave up sort of... It became a little bit boring. By mid-century, a lot of folks felt like they were just kind of going through motions, and there was humanism and rationality. We didn't believe in any of this stuff anyway, right? And out here in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, there was really kind of a backlash against that rationalism. And one of the places that American Jews really came to in the 60s was Buddhism. You know, big time. And you guys know kind of some of the folks that that came out of that, great Buddhist writers, who might have some Jewish, you know, ancestry. You know, Judaism wasn't quite doing it. And this was really before Kabbalah was available. You know, the Zohar is written in Aramaic, and, you know, not very many people can read Aramaic. And so that was one way that in ancient times, well, and even in modern times, it was kept from the masses. But now that there are translations available, it's become sort of, there's been a resurgence of interest. But a lot of Jews turned to Buddhism because Judaism just wasn't doing it, you know? And what I like most about, you know, being here in these kind of interfaith context is, personally, is that interacting with Buddhism and sitting in Zazen makes me a better Jew. Definitely. It's no, absolutely, right? My hope is that the Dharma talk given by me as a guest will help you to become better Buddhists. And I think that we do grow in our own traditions by having that dialogue and interacting. And I think that's where our kind of spiritual ancestors were. You know, they really exchanged some ideas and came away from it richer in their own traditions. And it does say to me that there's really something there. You know, if you can help me see something that really is authentically Jewish, but that I wouldn't have seen if I hadn't spent time with you, then, you know, that's pretty good. It speaks to the reality of that original person.
Maybe that's a good stopping point. Unless there's one more question. Never mind. Maybe afterwards.
Okay. I can maybe talk about it quickly if you want. All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you again.